I think I've always been curious, curious about other people's stories, curious about sharing stories. The fashion industry, although it's a big billion-dollar industry, I mean, there's a lot about it that's kind of vacuous. And so for me, creating stories within my work felt a bit more purposeful. And what a lot of people don't know is that every collection that I designed was actually a life lesson that I was learning at the time. And so when I reflect on my body of work, I actually can see all these life lessons that I had
Amazing.
learned. For me, it wasn't so much even about selling the collection. I felt more profoundly impacted by the work itself than I did about anything to do with the bottom line.
Welcome to the Calgary Sessions. This is episode number 112. I'm your host, Jeff Humphreys. Before we get into the show, just a quick ask. If you like this show, I'm asking you one thing. Share it with one friend. We're trying to get some more exposure around it, so if you could do that for me, I would be very much appreciative. Today's guest. This name, I've known the name in the city. You don't know any of this, by the way. I've known your name in the city for so long, just like from working in clubs and just being in that nightlife world, and I'm sure we know mutual friends, but
which is funny because I never went to
it's just like the
nightclubs.
name, though. Your name has been around the city for so long, so I'm pumped that you agreed to be on the show. So please name
Well,
and
thank you for having me.
yeah, name
Appreciate
and who
it.
you are.
My name's Paul Hardy, and I am a human, but my profession is a creative director, designer of a business that I've had for a little more than 20 years now.
Amazing. Yeah, this is gonna be a cool one because I'm very fascinated to hear how you got into it and all of it. So,
Sure.
have you seen one of these? Did you watch Pulse?
I did. I
Okay.
watched Pulse,
Okay, cool. So you got a little context. So take it back as far as you want to go. I'd love to hear, how you grew up, where you grew up, who inspired you at a young age, how your parents kind of influenced you, and then you and I will just talk about the path and where you are today.
Well, I was born and raised in Winnipeg. I come from four generations of bankers and accountants, so creative streaks and design did not run rampant in my family. My mother recalls telling me that when I was 3 years old, I used to pull on her pant leg saying, "I want to sew, I want to sew." And so I've just always believed that it was kind of an innate sort of calling. For myself, my parents were a bit perplexed, I suspect, as to what to do with me as a child. And thankfully, my great aunt on my mother's side was essentially like Martha Stewart about 50 years before her time. And when I had days off from school or vacation time, they used to bring me to her house, and she would teach me all sorts of things from quilting to beading, embroidery, learning to sew, obviously, setting a table, all these kinds of different, these different creative applications that I have continued to use long into my career afterwards. And then I guess the next sort of stone, as it were. I kind of, there's this biblical story where Israelites used to lay stones and as like markers. And so I sort of refer to these things as stones. But when I was in grade six, I did a social studies project and created Aboriginal Barbie clothing, very politically incorrect for the time. Blonde haired, blue eyed Barbies wearing Aboriginal clothing. That speaks to the era in which I grew up about cultural sensitivity. That was sort of what kind of affirmed to me that I would go into some form of design. I wasn't sure at the time if it was going to be interiors or fashion. And then in grade seven, I met my grade seven teacher named Irene Coaches, who I'm still friends with to this day. And I don't think I ever saw her wear the same outfit twice for the entire school year. And she just became like this, you know, kind of style icon to me. And she had come, she was from Winnipeg originally, but she had gone and taught in international schools overseas. And she had come back and she had this like crazy wardrobe for Winnipeg. You know, she had these cropped bolero LaCroix looking jackets with pom-poms on them. And, you know, I was fascinated by her. And she was the first person who actually encouraged me to go into fashion design.
Were you wildly different compared to your like other kids and people around you? Like, did you have a circle around you that was interested in the same things?
No, I was definitely a lone wolf for sure. I think I existed in a bit of a blissful bubble in a way, because I never thought that what my interests were or my skill sets or abilities were something unnormal. I mean, granted, I didn't have the same interests as most boys. And growing up in Winnipeg at that time, you know, I was ridiculed a lot and was sort of ostracized by my own gender. So I really found myself in the company of female friendships for the most part. And, you know, the concepts of bullying and conversations surrounding that were not a topic of conversation. It was just, in our day, you just sort of took it on the chin and soldiered on kind of thing. So, for me, I I don't feel emotionally scarred by my childhood. I think it shaped who I was or am. Anyway, it was a bit
different.
It was different for sure at that time. But I do think for my age, and certainly in, you know, observing friends pass who, even as adults, they still struggle to figure out what their direction and purpose in life is. I had a very definitive idea about what I wanted to do. And, you know, oddly enough, I didn't feel deterred in any way. It had never even occurred to me that what I was envisioning for my life wasn't possible. I don't know where that state of mind comes from, because I do really empathize a lot with people who struggle to figure out what it is that they want to do as a profession. But perhaps it's because I kind of viewed Like I've always sort of looked at my life in two ways. Like, you know, design is really just what I do. It's not who I am. And so it's never felt like a job per se. And when I was in high school, I had discovered that they had one of the only, I think at that time, the only high school programs that offered a fashion curriculum. And it was on the other side of the city. And I was accepted into it, and it was paid for by the division, the school division I was in. And so I would do my academics at one high school, and then during my lunch hour, I would drive an hour across the city and do, you know, a vocational training. And I had consolidated 2 of 3 years into 1 year. In order to, during my graduating year of high school. And I come from a very devout Christian family, and my faith has always been super important to me. And my parents were, I think, concerned about me, you know, falling into this kind of materialistic, hedonistic lifestyle that really was at the time, you know, of the fashion industry, like Studio 54 and, you know, and so they were concerned about my, I think my career path from that perspective. And so I ended up going to Bible school in England after I graduated high school.
Your own choice, or?
I felt like it would kind of ground me in a way. It hadn't deterred me from going into fashion. I just felt like it would be a personal, foundational kind of thing that I wanted to do before I went into university pursuits. And so I went to this school in the north of England, and it's quite amusing because I used to do fashion shows at this Bible school during the coffee hours by taking the bed sheets and pinning them together into outfits, no way. And the curtains, like very kind of almost like Gone with the Wind, you know. And I made outfits out of toilet paper, and the headmistress of the school was getting mad at me because I was wasting toilet paper, so I had to pay for the toilet paper I'd used. And so it was interesting because when I had gone to apply to Ryerson University, I had videotape of these fashion shows. And when I went to do my interview, they had forgotten to book the VCR. Maybe your younger viewers will need a caption to explain what that is. But anyway, and they asked me what was on the videotape. And I said, well, I just finished going to a Bible school, and I used to do these fashion shows at this school. And so these were, you know, excerpts from that. And I remember the professor's mouth just dropping open and saying, you used to do fashion shows at a Bible school? And he's like, wow, the church really is changing. And I said, well, you know, the principles are still there, but I think it's progressing for the better. And so then I ended up going to Ryerson and spent 4 years there. And in my final year, I had won a number of industry awards. That essentially opened the door for me to go and pursue, you know, a career.
Yep.
And
did it surprise you? Did it surprise you when you were winning the awards and accomplishing a few things at a younger age? Like, were you surprised, or were you like, this feels comfortable?
Well, because I had like a, I guess, quote unquote gap year,
yeah.
I didn't go to university right out of high school. And so I guess I did my university degree as a quote unquote mature student, which I would highly recommend actually to most, you know, young adults. Is I think you have a better idea about and are more focused if you have a gap year, in a way, whether it's to travel or, you know, serve in some capacity. But anyway, so I always felt very confident about the body of work that I was creating. And I always did everything with the greatest level of excellence that I could. So I don't want it to sound boisterous to say that I wasn't surprised when I started winning awards. I remember, you know, kind of sitting in my bachelor suite bat cave of an apartment. And I had like $50 in my bank account and thought, now what? And I remember definitively like sort of praying about my circumstances at the time. And I, well, basically, I was at a crossroads, and this might not be totally understandable to people, but I felt like I had this conversation with God where he said, you know, you can try to do it your way and climb the corporate ladder and, you know, achieve what you want to, or you can, you know, put your life in my hands and you'll never know where I'll take you. And I'm like, well, I don't have a plan, so have at her, kind of thing. And it was literally like the next day that I won the first award, and then I won another one the following week. And there happened to be a woman who was emceeing one of the awards for the, it was a Student Designer of the Year Awards that was being hosted. And I had won that, and she was the MC at it. And very serendipitously, she happened to be in the MAC cosmetics store that one of my classmates was working at. And she, my classmate said, oh, you were the woman who hosted the awards that my friend just won. And she's like, oh my God, you know him? And her name was Sandra Patana. She used to be a fashion expert commentator on CityLine. And she was wanting to get a hold of me because she wanted to buy parts of my collection. And so she called me up out of the blue and said, I want to buy you know, some of your work. And so she became my first official client, I guess. And then took it upon herself, actually, to call the fashion directors of Holt Renfrew. And so she arranged for me to meet with Ian Hilton, who is a very accomplished industry professional since his tenure at Holtz. And he, it was funny, he was a bit skeptical when he first met me. He said, you know, oh, why do you think you need to leave Canada? Everyone thinks they need to leave Canada. And I said, well, just, you know, look at my portfolio. And he flipped through my portfolio and he handed the book back to me and he says, get out of the country as fast as you can. And I thought you just told me, you know, to stay. And he said, most people I meet, I don't think have the goods, but he says, I think you do. And so, so he suggested that I go to New York. And
how old are you about when this is all kind of happening?
I was 23.
That's pretty young.
22?
Yep.
Yeah. So because I had won some award money, I ended up finding a one-way ticket to New York for $120, open-ended. It's kind of crazy. That wouldn't have existed back then. And I thought, well, you know, where am I going to stay kind of thing? And my mom called me up and said, you know, we were telling your cousin about, you know, you going to New York. Well, it turns out that, you know, one of my cousins lived in New York and was this really up and coming, like, tech kind of, you know, startup kind of guy, owned a beautiful brownstone in Brooklyn, Park Slope, and invited me to come and stay with him and his girlfriend. And so I had a place to stay. And anyway, the day before I left, I got a call from Ian Hilton, and he had gone and photocopied his entire address book and gave it to me and said, you know, get on the phone and good luck. And so I started calling, like, the offices of, you know, Donna Karen and Isaac Mizrahi and Jeffrey Bean and Oscar De La Renta, and all these people, like, the doors kind of opened up for me to meet and interview with all these different people. And there was a former editor of Vogue magazine named Eleanor Lambert, who at the time was probably in her 90s. And she was infamous for having these lunches at her Park Avenue penthouse during Fashion Week, and people would come for this, like, macaroni salad to her house. And she had all these, you know, amazing stories. And so anyway, I called her up, and she said to me, well, are you a designer? And it was the first time anyone had ever asked me that question. And so I paused for a second. I said, well, yeah, I guess I am. And she asked me, you know, who my work was most similar to at the time. And back then, I had kind of focused on a lot of, like, evening wear, sort of special occasion type of things. And I said, well, you know, people were comparing me to, like, Jeffrey Bean or Bill Blass or Oscar De La Renta. And she said, okay, you can meet them. And I was, you know, she hadn't even met me in person, and I was a bit astounded. And I said, well, wouldn't you like to see my portfolio first before you recommend me? And she said, well, you wouldn't be calling me if you didn't have the goods. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting perspective. Mm. So at that time, there was no cell phones. I used to have to run home to, or run to my cousin's place to check the voicemail tape to see if anyone had called, you know. And anyways, she phoned and she said, well, I've recommended you for the head design position of a company. And I said, well, I thought you wanted me to meet with Oscar de la Renta's people or whatever. I said, well, word on the street is that you're doing quite fine on your own. And I don't know who she had been talking to, but it all felt like it was some sort of, you know, like scripted, like Hollywood sort of thing. But anyway, she said, you know, do you know who Josie Natori is? And I said, no. And she said, well, you should. And Josie Natori is a very elegant and accomplished designer who was most known for her loungewear. And she was planning on starting an evening wear line. And so she said that she had spoken with the CEO of Natori, which was this woman named Kitty D'Alessio. And she said, do you know who she is? And I said, no. And she says, well, you should. And she used to be the CEO of Chanel. So the next thing I knew, I was in Josie Natori's office showing her my portfolio. I still remember she had the most beautiful office. It was all like burlwood inlay with white orchids, and she was wearing this white suit with a leopard blouse that had this big bow, starched bow collar. She was so elegant, and still is. I've heard that she's a very accomplished concert pianist and performs at like Carnegie Hall and stuff. And so anyway, I'm sitting there at her office in my Armani suit that I had bought at Value Village before I had left Toronto. I think I paid $30 for it, and I'm pretty sure it was like a size or two too big for me. But it was a look. Anyway, she kind of flipped through, and she says, I don't know. She says, well, do you have any questions for me? And I said, well, I'd like to know if you run your company with integrity, because I'm not interested in working for anybody who doesn't. And her head kind of cocked back, and she said, how old are you? And I said, 23. And she said, oh, just a baby. And so then she sent me down the hall to meet with Kitty. And so I showed Kitty. Kitty was so lovely to me. And so they asked me if I would put together some conceptual drawings of what I thought that the collection should be like. And so I continued to meet with other designers, but I was working on that at the same time. And I went back to show them, and they weren't ready to make a decision yet. So I decided that in the interim, they were going to decide in the fall. And at this time, it was like kind of high summer. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up going to Calgary during the summer, because my friend, my old roommate was getting married from university, was getting married. And I ended up meeting a bunch of friends here. And I spent about 3 weeks here. And one of my friends here offered to drive me back in his truck and move me to New York. And this was the plan, is that I was going to move to New York with just on a leap of faith kind of thing. And so I got back to Toronto, and within like 24 hours, I had sold most of my possessions. Just randomly, people phoning me up, asking me how I was doing. I was like, well, I'm going to move to New York. Oh, do you want to sell anything? And like, it was just, I don't know, it was very surreal how it all played out. And we packed up his pickup truck with all of my worldly possessions. And we got to the border, which, I mean, this would be unheard of today. But at the time, we were at the Buffalo border, and they said, oh, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm going to move to New York to look for a job. And they're like, okay, good luck to you. And so we just kind of went. And the day before I left, friends of mine that I had gone to Bible school with in England knew about people who lived on the Upper East Side of New York in this gorgeous, like, apartment that had a grand piano suspended in the stairwell. And anyway, they gave me a place to stay. And so I was staying there while I was looking for a job. And then through a number of contacts, anyway, this is becoming a very long-winded story, sorry. This is just the first year before I even started. But anyway, I was, all this to say that I was up for a head design position of a company. And out of the blue, people started saying, you should really move to Calgary. You should really move to Calgary. I thought, why would I want to move to Calgary? I'm going to move, you know, be in New York. But I'm not one of those people who discounts, things as just being off the cuff. Like, I always think, you know, you pay attention to sort of signs or, you know, and, so again, similar to when I graduated, I said, well, God, you know, if you want me to go to Calgary, then, you know, I need a place to live, a way to get there, and a job offer. And literally within 24 hours, I had a ride, a place to live, and a job offer. And so I came to Calgary on Valentine's Day in 1998.
No way.
And I thought that I was only going to be here for about a year, year and a half. I had left everything I owned in New York with actually models who were from Alberta that worked for Mode Models, but I had subsequently ended up living with them while I was in New York. And well, I've been here for 25 years now. Yes. So...
what was the job that brought you here?
I was, well, it was Gail O'Brien, who was the general manager of Holt Renfrew at the time here, who was, we had a number of mutual acquaintances. She had heard about me through Kelly Strait of Mode Models. And at the time, they had just moved from Penny Lane to, well, now where Brooks Brothers is, and they were expanding into a designer business because prior to me coming, they, you know, their idea of designer brands were like DKNY, which I don't even think exists anymore, and, you know, on the higher end, Armani Collezioni, which was really his bridge line to his higher end line. And so when they built this three-floor store, they and had, you know, a Chanel boutique, and they started carrying Dolce & Gabbana and Prada. And at the time, these were all, you know, cutting-edge designers that people were not well acquainted with as they are today.
And that was early in Calgary too, right? Like, there were those brands showing up in Calgary were
1998. And, you know, at the time Prada was, you know, making those nylon seatbelt strap purses that were, you know, $700 and nobody could understand why. And so, I said to Gail, well, I'm interested in becoming a personal shopper for Holt Renfrew. And she said, well, we don't have a need for that. And I said, well, then I'll create the need. And so I worked for them for 4 years to build up their designer business. And when I left, they had private dressing rooms with a kitchen to serve food and wine to clients. And they hired three people to replace me when I left. And so I then started my collection in the basement kitchen studio of my, well, I had a studio basement apartment, and I started my collection in the kitchen. And out of the blue, this guy called me up and he says, oh, I think I read about you in a magazine. And I was thinking, there's no way, because I've never been in a magazine. But anyway, and he was a fabric salesman. Hmm. And he had all these fabrics that I had recognized from collections that I had sold at Holt Renfrew. And so he said, you know, we take 50% and then you pay the rest when we ship, and you can buy minimums of 10 meters. And so I put together a series of illustrations. And after I had left Holtz, a number of my clients who I had become, you know, friendly with,
yep,
had asked me what I was up to and how I was doing. And
did you have anything on, like, were you all in on starting your own thing at this time?
No. Basically, a client of mine, it was a very random sort of series of events, but one of my clients called me up out of the blue and said that there was this sales rep for a Canadian designer that was based out of Vancouver but was really quite well known, or sort of cutting edge well known, like Madonna had worn her clothes and so forth. And I was familiar with the collection because they had carried it briefly at Holt Renfrew. And so she was essentially doing a trunk show in this woman's house and invited me to come over. And I started thinking, oh, so-and-so would love this, and so-and-so would love this. And so I started calling all these people. And, you know, it was funny because, again, we didn't have cell phones back then. And so I memorized everybody's number. Wow. You know, I could dial, you know, phone numbers without even having to, like, look them up any. Mm-hmm. And so I started calling all my former clients, well, a number of them, who I thought would like these pieces. And I sold probably, you know, $15,000 or $20,000 of this woman's collection in an afternoon. It was like high-end Tupperware, basically, you know. And so, and the woman, I think, was so taken back. She was just like, wow, score. Who is this guy, you know? And so I went back to my place and I thought, you know, well, I could do this. I could put together a collection and do like a little trunk. I mean, you know, we would sort of equate it to a pop-up shop now, you know. Yeah. It was the primitive form of, yeah, pop-up shop. So this was my idea, is that I was going to do a pop-up shop. And I remember journaling, saying, you know, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but well, I had read this scripture, because I'm a good Christian boy, that, you know, see, I am making a way in the desert. I'm paving a way through dry lands. And I'm totally paraphrasing this because it's escaping me at the moment. But but anyway, it, rivers in the dry lands is what it was. And I had journaled, you know, if you build it, they will come, like Field of Dreams kind of thing. And so 9 of my clients, who I'm still friends with to this day, I said to them, look, I will give you an outfit at wholesale if you would prepay for it. And they bought the outfit based on my illustrations. And so that was, I managed to collect, I think it was $13,000.
Yeah.
And that was how I paid for the fabrics. I decided that my first collection was going to be black and white because it was two colors of thread. It was the easiest way to do it. And I thought that I could dye a bunch of the fabrics from white to black, which was a whole learning experience in itself, because I had discovered that depending on what the type of silkworm is, silk all dyes differently. So some will dye black red and black blue and black, you know, undertones, right? So I had designed this collection all based on silence, and it was inspired by a biblical story of the Israelites overthrowing this city called Jericho. And the idea was that in the midst of silence, we're spoken to. And so, you know, black and white was sort of like you're either listening or you aren't kind of thing. And so as I'm building this collection, Kelly Strait ends up having dinner with Barb Atkin, who I'm still friends with to this day. She, at the time, was the fashion director of Holt Renfrew, and she and I were acquainted with one another from when I worked at the store. And she was asking how I was doing, and he says, oh, he's making all these crazy clothes in this back cave of an apartment. And so she showed up at my house, knocking on the basement window at 11 o'clock at night, wanting to see what I was working on. And she's like, this is amazing. You should be showing this in Paris, whatever. Well, she went back to Toronto, told the president of the Fashion Design Council of Canada about me. She flew out to meet me. I told her my whole story, and they asked me to open the ready-to-wear shows in Toronto. So this was the whole idea of if you build it, they will come. So I ended up going out to Toronto to show my first collection, and I really didn't know anything about putting a fashion show together as far as like booking the models, you know, shoe suppliers, hair and makeup. And so I thought, well, I have scraps of fabric left over. I'll just make them headscarves and they can, you know, that'll take care of their hair. And, you know, for the makeup, I just had them all wear like basic foundation and white eyeshadow. And I think it was like, I'd have to look back at the pictures, but it was anyway, very matte. And I didn't know where to find a shoe supplier, so I just decided that they'd all wear bare feet. And I didn't know where I'd find a DJ. And I thought, well, the collection's based on silence, so I might as well just show it to complete silence. And very serendipitously, one of my clients who invested in, well, bought one of my first outfits, I call them my early adopters, she grew up in this small town of 500 in Saskatchewan. And as it happens, she ended up going to high school, which was the then and president of Elite Models at the time. And so in Canada. And so she called him and asked him to, you know, help me out. I'm convinced now that she probably like supplemented. I mean, I've never actually asked her, but I've always suspected that she paid models extra because they gave me such a low rate. It was crazy. And so I had these models. My friend let me use her apartment to do the fittings. And so the head agent came to see my collection and was super impressed with it. And unbeknownst to me, took it upon himself to call every major editor that was important at that time and said, if there's one show that you need to see, it's this guy's show. And so he also called Jeannie Becker. And the next thing I knew, Jeannie had shown up at, like she did on New Music, showed up at my door, knocking on the door, wanting to interview me. And so so when I did the show, I didn't have a ton of people come to the show because nobody knew who I was. But I had every major person that was important at that time there. And the Globe and Mail and Jeannie for the National Post wrote these huge articles on my show, and that essentially is what launched my career.
Crazy.
So, anyway.
At like,
that was a lot of word vomit for you. No, I'm sorry.
It's unbelievable to hear these stories firsthand, because everyone sees people at the, you know, where they are right now, right?
Yeah.
And they, you know, some people might question how they do it.
Yeah.
Some people might think it's overnight.
Well.
So to hear this.
And you know, it's interesting because I've. Like, there's an opposing tension, because often when I'm interviewed by design students and stuff, they say, you know, how did you start your career or whatever? I'm like, well, it was pretty unconventional. You know, I wouldn't say that my path could be replicated by another person. The only thing that I know is that, you know, my faith has always been a driving force behind my life and my business. And so I can only speak to my own human experience with that. And, you know, I do very much believe in the idea of, you know, preparation meets opportunity kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I always, you know, a pastor once said to me, like, whatever you do, always do things with the greatest level of excellence you can, because that's your calling card. That's, you know, the quote unquote only Bible that people are going to read kind of thing. And so it sort of stuck with me. And when I did my first collection, I mean, I made every single piece myself for the show. And I made every invitation myself. And so it wasn't because, you know, I didn't want to live in hypotheticals. Yeah. I thought I have to be able to do the greatest level of excellence I can with what I have to work with. And actually, as a shout out to my boss, Gail O'Brien, who brought me here, at the time, she moved to Toronto because her husband had retired as the CEO of CP Rail. And they had moved into a beautiful penthouse in Toronto. And she had called me up and asked me how she could help me out. And I said, well, you could throw a press brunch for me in your house. I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, honestly, some of these asks that I had as a young upstart, I don't know if I would have the same balls to do it now. I think I was just, I don't know. I guess I was sort of, I never felt like, and I still to this day, like with my career, I feel like it's just something that I'm stewarding as opposed to owning it myself. I feel like, you know, it's been gifted to me. And so when I bring other people in to do collaborations and things with me, I feel like it's for the greater good of something in some way. And so I had asked her if she would do this, and she had probably moved into the place about 2 weeks before. I don't even think any of her friends had been there. And she hosted 60 people in her house. We set up in her bedroom my collection to make it feel like this woman's boudoir, you know? And at the time, it was like the building she had moved into was sort of the talk of the town. And I think it piqued most press people's curiosity, thinking, who is this guy and how does he know all these people? And Holtz had just opened a restaurant. It was like their first one at the time. And she got them to cater it. I mean, it was really, like, when I reflect on it, it was so humbling that everyone rallied, you know, to help me out. And I suppose, you know, part of that maybe speaks to my character and the relationship that I had with these people and their belief in me. Mm-hmm. But that was essentially how it all kind of unfolded. And then Holtz ended up picking up my collection in its first season, which was honestly kind of unheard of, because Lita Bidet, who was probably the top Canadian designer at the time and is a good friend of mine, it took her almost 3 years to get into Holt Renfrew. Mm-hmm. But I had said, it was funny, they came to see my collection. This is persistence. But they came to see my collection. They sent a junior buyer and they said, well, your stuff is too expensive. And I said, well, I find it really amusing that you are supposed to be supporting Canadian fashion, and yet don't believe that Canadian designers can compete on the same level as other international designers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was like, my fabrics all come from Europe, you know. There was nothing that was different. But they ended up picking up my collection in its first season, and I sold to them for pretty much exclusively. I mean, we had a few smaller boutiques initially, yep. But I had always kind of wanted to just kind of deal with them for the first 10 seasons. Mm. But I had this weird... Well, it was not really weird. It was an unconventional approach to business, and maybe this is sort of the left brain banker side of my family. But I never wanted to sell more to Holt than what I was selling personally, because I thought if I ever lost them as an account, that I would go under. Mm. So I continued on with my, you know, high-end Tupperware trunk shows in people's houses and still sold to Holt Renfrew. And so everything that I made from Holtz was just kind of gravy. And I used my own sales as sort of the operational mm-hmm. costs. So when the idea of pop-up shops came up years later, it was something that I was really familiar with. Yeah. But I think it was because in my second season, I had gone to Bergdorf Goodman. They actually had said, oh, we'll buy $100,000 of your collection, but whatever we don't sell at regular price, we want to ship back to you. And I thought, well, that's no deal. But as I was walking through their store, you know, I would see like a rack about this big with like, maybe less than 10 pieces on it, and would have John Galliano's name above it. And I thought, well, that's all they bought of the designer's collection, you know? And so there was this, I don't know, it was like a light bulb moment for me in my mind, that being in certain stores is just like vanity for retail, but it's not a means of survival. And for me, like, I was like, press doesn't pay your bills, and neither do these people. So I'm going to have to, like, kind of beat to my own drum sort of thing. And so I've never kind of, I guess, played the game, as it were.
Yep.
And I've been able to kind of pave my own path as a result.
Do you think that, what do you think of, a lot of people won't think like that. You know, a lot of people kind of go down the path of, you know, stroking their ego. Mm-hmm. You get tied to these big names, but when the finances don't work behind the scenes, they kind of get chewed up. So what do you think got you on that path?
I had really good advisors. Mm. Surrounding me. My father's always been a great source of advice. I mean, he knows nothing about the business, and he often would just sort of stand back and let me kind of, you know, I knew that he was there to support me if I ever had, you know, wanted to bounce ideas off of him. But I think when you're sort of thrown into the deep end of things, you have to learn how to swim.
Yeah.
And I realized, like, I, you know, it was my business and I had to champion it the best way I knew how. And I wasn't going to become, like, I wasn't going to fall on a sword for, you know, out of pride. You know, there's this proverb that says a haughty spirit comes before a fall. And so I've just always thought I need to, and I'm a Taurus. I crave authenticity. You know, it's kind of innately who I am. So I've just never, I never wanted to be beholden to somebody else. One of my life mottos is don't exist at the mercy of your circumstances. And so I never wanted to be in a situation where I felt like, I, you know, was at somebody else's mercy.
Where does talent fit in all this? You talked about faith and opportunity. Where's just like raw talent and just like, it's just part of who you are?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess if I didn't have talent, I wouldn't be where I am.
Yeah.
You know, I can't really explain where it comes from other than, you know, my personal belief that it's, you know, something greater than myself that is sort of transcending through me. I really believe that, you know, I mean, whatever your personal, spiritual, religious beliefs are, I believe that we're human beings living a spiritual experience, or spiritual beings living a human experience, sorry. And so I think that we have an ability to co-create with, you know, God, the universe, however you want to define it, energy, whatever your, you know, term is. That's how I kind of operate in my design philosophy, in that I try to create, I view myself as a visual storyteller, regardless of what the medium is. And so everything has like an intention and a meaning behind it, whether it's, you know, fashion collections, which all had stories to them, or if it's on the interior side of things, which I branched out into in curating people's homes, that it become a reflection of who they are, their interests, you know, and that it serves, it almost is like a visual love letter to the people. And I've kind of done that with all of my creative endeavors, whether it was designing the costumes for Sarah McLachlan's ballet, or you know, curating merchandise for the Stampede, my residency with the Glenbow Museum, and curating an exhibition for them. It was all intended to somehow be for the benefit of other people.
The storytelling piece, I find that fascinating because, you know,
because you're you capture people's stories. So you, makes sense.
It's how do you, what's at the root of that? Like, how do you really explain? Like, you briefly touched on, like, you know, when you're curating their house, like who they are, how it ties all together. But how do you explain that to people? And this is a deeply personal question, because when I say, like, digital storyteller is what I do.
Yeah.
You know, it can go a bunch of different ways. The visual storyteller. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, if I spiritualize it, it's the method of communication of how Jesus used to operate. He spoke in parables. He spoke in stories. Good friends of mine who I went to Bible school with, who later went on into ministry endeavors, became pastors of a small parish in Scotland. And they told me this really interesting story about how someone in their village passed away, and everybody came for the funeral. And at the end of the, benediction or whatever, this woman stood up and started singing Amazing Grace. And it was, now it's blank, you got me.
It'll come back.
It'll come back to me. She was the Scottish woman who was on, why is this blanking on me now? This is terrible. You're going to have to edit this.
No way. This is like the series digging.
Susan Boyle, thank you. See? Susan Boyle stood up
and
started singing Amazing Grace. And everybody was like gobsmacked. Oh my God, it's Susan Boyle, it's Susan Boyle. And like word spread like wildfire throughout, you know, the hamlets, that Susan Boyle was at this thing. And they had said, you know, this is essentially what like the early church was, is that everyone had a story, people feel connected to it, and, you know, you share it with other people because it's part of the human experience and growing. And so I think I've always been curious, you know, curious about other people's stories, curious about sharing stories. And I think, you know, the fashion industry, although it's a big billion-dollar industry, I mean, there's a lot about it that's kind of vacuous. And so for me, you know, creating stories within my work felt a bit more purposeful. And what a lot of people don't know, unless I'm talking to them like I'm talking to you, is that every collection that I designed was actually a life lesson that I was learning at the time. And so when I reflect on my body of work, I actually can see all these life lessons that I had learned. And it, so for me, it wasn't so much even about selling the collection. I mean, obviously I did it as a livelihood, but I felt more profoundly impacted by the work itself than I did about anything to do with the bottom line. So, and I had determined that, for better or worse, coming from a banking family, that it wasn't about, you know, making millions of dollars at this. It was about challenging the ideas of other people. And, you know, in my third season, which was the first collection I showed in New York, a fashion editor came up to me afterwards. She said, "I think I finally get what you're doing." And I said, "Oh, really? Please tell me, because I don't even know." And she said, "You're branding a social concept as opposed to a visible brand." And I said, "Explain that to me." And she says, "I know from the point of knowing what your inspiration is to the invitation, to the program, to the show itself, to the collection. It's all pieces of a puzzle that are being put together. And I know that when I come to one of your shows, I'm going to be challenged by an idea that I have the responsibility as to whether or not I'm going to act upon what I've learned. And I was not cognizant to that at the time, but it profoundly impacted how I moved forward and what I did, that everything became a lot more intentional.
Yep.
And so sure enough, after every show that I had done, somebody would come up to me and say, you know, what was that really all about? Or they would have questions about it. And that was where the joy really came for me, is feeling like somebody's life had somehow changed. So when people ask me, you know, what is your career highlight? And a lot of people would think, oh, showing in LA Fashion Week or New York Fashion Week or the first thing I did in Paris or whatever. And for me, it is the hidden stories of connection that I have with specific clients, like, you know, dresses that I designed for daughters' graduations or weddings, or, you know, you become embedded into the cellular memories of people's lives. Yeah. And ultimately, that's what life is about. It's about relationships. So that's sort of where I feel most gratified in what I've done.
That sounds like a very profound moment when she explained like that.
I was like, whoa,
that's a lot to,
yeah,
a lot to digest.
Yeah, it was, it really changed, how I worked. Everything, about that. It was really interesting, because that particular show, like, she was telling me people were crying in the audience and all this stuff. It was the worst selling collection I had ever produced. And to this day, it was my favorite one, because honestly, it was not a very well-designed collection. It was probably one of my weaker ones. But the whole collection was about the idea of grace and mercy, and that, are you willing to extend the same level of grace and mercy to other people as you have for yourself? And it profoundly changed the way I related to people. Because I think I didn't really understand the fullness of that concept until I had designed this collection. It was all actually inspired by a biblical story. I don't design solely biblical stories. It just so happens that it was, you know, it. But it was a fascinating, I can share it with you if you really want to hear it.
Yeah.
But it was about this Samaritan woman who had 5 husbands and 1 lover. And so the collection was all designed that each, they were 5 capsule collections within one major collection, each representing a different relationship that she had. And I started thinking about her in a modern day sense, that she was sort of like the Sex and the City character, you know, that she was reading her Cosmo magazine, shacked up at her boyfriend's place. And I started to kind of break down the historical part of it. because Jesus ended up meeting this woman at a well. And it said that he met her at the sixth hour, which I always thought was like 6 a.m. or 6 p.m. because it was the coolest points in the day. But according to the Jewish clock, it was actually high noon, which would have been the most uncomfortable point of the day, and explained why nobody else was around, and sort of intimated that she was this kind of social outcast because she couldn't go to the well, because women used to kind of go together. So, and Jesus was kind of risking his own reputation if anyone had been around, because men didn't really talk to women in public unless it was to proposition them at the time. And we never know her name. And I think that was deliberately done, because we can all be this person. We all have baggage. And essentially, Jesus cut all through that and was like, I don't see you for what you've done. I see you for who you are and what you've become. And so they had this conversation. She runs back to the city, and it says that she made people listen to her. So she must have created quite a spectacle for herself. And all these people came back to the town, and the whole town, you know, had kind of a revival of sorts. I mean, this is a paraphrase of it all. Mm-hmm. But it was essentially that, you know, how often do we discount people based on what they've done? We write them off. And, but what a person's done doesn't necessarily represent who they are, and no one is beyond redemption. And that was what that collection taught me. And there were people who came up to me afterwards who said that they had harbored guilt and shame in their life, and that collection spoke to them and realized that they could rise above that. And I know of at least 11 people that told me that their lives were, that they were essentially set free from that. And that was when I realized, like, the power that, you know, art and design have to be able to speak to people without words. And so even though it was a disaster for sales, it's still one of my favorite collections because it taught me probably one of the most valuable life lessons that I've ever learned.
That, the art and design piece, how do you, like that feeling you had from that show, you're carrying it with you to this day. Mm-hmm. Everything you do from that point forward, are you trying to not recreate it, but just be very mindful of, be very intentional with what you're doing?
Yeah, like every season I'll say, you know, what am I to learn this season? Or, you know, what am I to say through this work? For me, like with Sarah McLachlan's ballet, so there are two things that I revere in this world. One are artists, painters, and the other are ballet dancers, because both, in my opinion, have an ability to speak without words and evoke an emotion. And they do it at such a personal sacrifice to themselves, physically, mentally, financially. And more often than not, they'll never get to meet the people that they actually have impacted. Yeah. And so to me, they're like angelic beings. So when I was asked to design these costumes, and Sarah happened to be a personal friend of mine because we had worked together when she had been honored with the Alan Waters Humanitarian Award at the Junos, and I had designed all of her outfits for that season. And so when it came up that they were going to be doing this ballet, you know, she had asked if I would do the costumes for it. So I took it very seriously because I wanted it to be a kind of love letter to the ballet dancers and a love letter to her about a reflection of her music and her, who she was. I wanted it to kind of try to capture her essence. And it, similarly with the museum exhibition, I learned a lot from that because it was all based on man's relationship with animals and design, and how that relationship has influenced fashion, interiors, lifestyle, branding. And as I started researching the idea of that, I became more acutely aware of how pervasive it is, dating back to, you know, tribal times when, you know, like huntsmen used to kill the bear and eat their heart, thinking that they would take on, you know, courage and bravery. All the way to today, when a woman wears like a leopard print bra, or a guy drives a Jaguar, or a sports team's named after, you know, an animal. Like, obviously, there's the similar psychology to why we feel connected to those sorts of characteristics and attributes. And we see it woven into like cereal boxes. And, you know, it's just, it's amazing to me the interplay that humanity has with animals and how that has influenced all of our aesthetic and kind of way of life. And so I thought that would be a relatable topic that would be enlightening to the masses. And so it was just a joy to do, and it became incredibly successful exhibit for the museum, which subsequently they ended up asking me to join the board of the museum, and I've been helping to champion their, you know, with the revitalization of the museum and its new opening upcoming.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How do you, what kind of pushes you forward creatively, you know, for where you are right now? And, you know, we've talked about it, all the little moments of your journey till right now. How does, how do you fit creativity into your like vision going forward?
That's a good question. Well, before we started this conversation, I said to you, I'm a real techno peasant. And so I'm thinking I'm having to try to, you know, relearn or learn. You know, the industry itself has changed so much that I feel like I'm having to relearn it in a lot of different ways. So there's a creative element to that. But, you know, I hope that I'll just be able to continue to kind of tell stories from a visual perspective.
Amazing. This has been really cool.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be able to spend time with you.
It's the minute you said storytelling the first time, I was like,
this is going to be a long one.
This is like, this is going to be awesome. I end the show with one question. When I say Calgary, where does your head go?
When you say Calgary, well, again, to our earlier conversation, I would say when I think of Calgary, I think pioneering spirit. And the fact that when I first moved here 25 years ago, it was a cultural wasteland, you know, in a lot of ways. And, you know, through the migration of different cultures and people moving here, we've seen a real progression of people, you know, building what what wasn't here, or creating, inventing. And that's one of the reasons why I've, when people ask me about Calgary, I'm like, it's the people. Mm. That's the selling feature of this city. Mm. It's the people. And so we're, you know, we're kind of stewards of that.
Mm. Amazing. Anyway. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Yeah, really cool. Like I kicked this thing off with, I've heard your name for so long. It's finally cool to meet you. Mm-hmm. And it's even cooler to just hear your story. So thanks again.
Well, I'll look forward to hopefully collaborating with you.
Sounds awesome. In the future.